This week on Making Contact.
We learn that defiance is contagious.
Solidarity has long been at the core for social change and global struggles. The uprisings of Tunisia and Egypt provide an inspiring backdrop for what solidarity in action can achieve. But here in the United States and other developed nations, strengthening solidarity has been met by social, economic, and political obstacles. And many are asking, where do we go from here?
We need to bring together the three dimensions of time, the past, the present, and the future.
On this edition, we examine this concept of a new solidarity. We take you to the Left Forum Conference in New York City for an in-depth look at what solidarity means today and the role of new technology that is unifying and informing people in ways never before seen. I'm Esther Minia, and this is Making Contact, a program connecting people, vital ideas, and important information. A political shift and a desire for change is happening in the United States as we witness a wave of mass mobilizations, from immigrants fighting for just reform, to the public outcry against government cuts and spending, to the outpouring of support for collective bargaining rights in Wisconsin. This upsurge in political activism is giving many Americans and people throughout the world hope for a new solidarity. A panel of visionary leaders addressed the issue at Left Forum's annual conference, Towards a Politics of Solidarity, featuring Paul Mason, Laura Flanders, and Cornel West on March 18, 2011, at Pace University in New York City. We begin today's show with Paul Mason, economics editor for BBC's Newsnight. Mason is also the author of Live Working, Die Fighting, and has covered globalization and social justice issues from around the world.
We are in the middle of a wave of discontent. In some countries, revolutions. In some countries, social upheavals. Rick listed them. In others, the revival of student and labor activism on levels not seen for a generation. Now, there are, of course, parallels with many revolutionary situations and waves. But I want to try and focus on what is new in the situation. Let's establish what we're talking about. In July 2009, the youth of Iran rose up in the green wave against the theft of the election. In December, it was called a Twitter revolution. In December 2009, there was a youth uprising in Greece against the police killing of a young protester. All the rest of the next year has been a cycle of general strikes, Molotov cocktails, political crisis in Greece, part of the Eurozone, for now. By October 2010, all over France, French students joined workers on the streets. Then, in November, British student demos and occupations began, trashing the party HQ of the Conservatives, leading to some 60 colleges, including all the big-name global universities. And then, Mohamed Bouazizi set himself on fire in a small town in Tunisia, and you don't need to be told the rest. Today, there are Saudi and Qatari tanks on the streets of Bahrain. There is an escalating military situation over Libya. There is an escalating diplomatic situation among Shia in the Middle East about the Bahraini crackdown, so a tiny country has a potentially detonating effect. There are live fire clashes on the streets of Yemen. Now, my job is to try and explain this, and in the story, I've noticed three things happening that I think are new, and I'm going to try and talk about them. The demographics, and the technology, and the behavior. Okay, in demographics, you've got youth without a future. In North Africa, you've got 20% youth unemployment in countries where two-thirds of the population are below the age of 30. In Europe, and for a layer in the Middle East, a crucial layer that helped start these revolutions, you have a more specific thing. That is the graduate without a future. For both sets of people, the economic crisis that began with Lehman Brothers was not just some downturn. It's turned the entire curve of their life upside down. Now they can only see their lives getting worse than those of their parents. It's clear that the austerity programs that are being heaped on top of the original recession that followed Lehman, and in this regard, Madison is a harbinger for you. We've already got it in Europe, and the rest of the world has this, the austerity. We're finding three sets of people who it's affecting. This graduate workforce and the students, the urban poor, and the organized working class. But what's new? Well, 20 years of neoliberalism have taught these people, all three sets of them, to be individualistic. to have what the sociologist Richard Sennett calls weak ties to each other, and to organizations, weak ties to their organizations, even weak ties to their own company. It created neoliberalism. They are the opposite of the worker in the Weberian sociological pyramid, in the hierarchy diagram. They work in networked organizations, their work is networked, their leisure is networked. They've begun to struggle using networks. Of course, each country has its own mix. The size of the urban poor, the radicalism of the student movement differs in every country. Either way, it all calls to mind for me the warning of Taine, the historian of the French Revolution. He said, when it comes to revolutions, don't just worry about the poor, worry about poor lawyers. Well, now, in every garret, there is a laptop. And this is where technology comes in. Of course, you'll be sick already of this debate. Was it the Facebook revolution? The Egyptian revolutionaries think it's an insult to call it a Facebook revolution. When they switched off the internet, they simply went onto the streets more. But I stand on the side that says these movements are being expressed through and created by a new technological reality. But it's not just or even primarily social media. Of course, Twitter, Facebook, YFrog allow protesters to mobilize quickly, to present to the mainstream media, people like me, undeniable evidence instantly, which allows us all to become witnesses, again, almost instantly, to acts of resistance and repression. Who can forget the placard in Tahrir Square? Mubarak, please go, my arms are tired. But it's a lot of other things. It's mobile telephony, it's mainstream media leverage, it's the sharing of cultural memes of resistance, the snatches of songs, the snatches of poetry, poetry chanted from the rooftops of Tehran during the crisis when you can't go on the streets. It's the constant photographing on cell phones which says to soldiers and policemen, you will end up at the International Criminal Court. In the debate that's broken out, Malcolm Gladwell famously says what's wrong with social networking is that it can only achieve small things. It can annoy, embarrass, but it couldn't have achieved what the civil rights movement achieved. And for that, you need hierarchy to confront hierarchy. I think if you study in detail what the April 6th movement did, they didn't just do social networking. They had a plan, a strategy borrowed from the Gene Sharp's famous strategy guide for nonviolent revolution. They had a network, if you read the interviews, of cells, quite similar to the way guerrilla movements organize. 50 people with one leader knows the other leaders, but nobody else does. What they'd learned, though, from the 20th century was to try, in the beginning, to inure themselves to the hierarchical dangers of nationalism, of Stalinism, of Islamism, because they had read more than the generation I came from. In addition, what they learned practically from the anarchist and eco-warrior tradition was the idea of creating spaces, and that space is a conquest. The Tahrir Square organizers had learned this, that many of them had experience of the Western student and eco-movement. And here, I think they've begun to do what the syndicalists did. They started to recognize that between reform and revolution, there is another space for the expanded control over your own life, over place, over culture, over personal relationships. I think another product of the new technological reality is that propaganda is beginning to become highly flammable, highly hard to make stick. Yes, you get spin doctors on Twitter. Yes, you get outright disinformation. But the truth acts like white blood cells, and it is more effective in a social media than in a mainstream media. Mainstream media is good at creating bubbles where people can believe a partial version of the truth. Social media is good at popping the bubble. That's all I claim for it, but I think you have to see it, and then when you've seen it used, it is an interesting part of the new reality. Finally, I'm going to talk about behavior. André Gortz is probably not the most popular person to bring up in the middle of American labor's greatest upsurge for 20 years, but he did write a book called Farewell to the Working Class. I don't agree with the thesis, but what he describes in terms of a revolution is very interesting. He says it's first and foremost the irreversible destruction of the machinery of domination. It implies a form of collective practice capable of bypassing and superseding it, that machinery, through the development of an alternative network of relations. And think this is what we're seeing from Tehran to Madison, is the development of alternative networks of relations and means of struggle that represent the fact that the swarm, the disorganized mass, organized through networks, can sometimes, and up to a point, defeat the hierarchy. There's a host of caveats. Some places they can switch the internet off. Some places the powerful are so strong because they have mass support. Iran, Ahmadinejad has the besieged militia, the poor. China, the Communist Party is a 60 million strong network. It functions like a network. But I want to finish, because I think these words do describe what is happening, with the words of one of the American student protesters. They'd gone into their college and set up a store, and the authorities didn't like it and called the cops. And the cops came to arrest somebody, so the students sat down around the police car. And one young guy, 21 years old, took off his shoes and stood on top of the police car and made a speech and began a mass meeting that lasted for 7 days. And later, he described what he'd felt. The act of sitting around the police car, of getting up on the car and starting to speak, of physically structuring the possibility of a community, he said. All of a sudden, there's a self-justifying factor to it. In a way, once it's been established, there might be other reasons for sitting around the police car than keeping it from moving. Namely, participating in the community. I have never experienced that nearly so strong as around the police car. Now, those are the words of Mario Savio. And the act I'm describing was in Berkeley in 1964. And you may have thought, and my colleagues in my profession may have thought, that such sentiments, such idealism, such ability to create the sudden community out of the empty space of isolated individuals, to achieve change through non-violence and through eloquence, you may have thought that the days of all that were gone. Well, they're back.
That was the voice of Paul Mason, author and economics editor for BBC's Newsnight, discussing forms of solidarity in mass movements throughout the world. Up next, we hear from Laura Flanders, author, host, and founder of Grit TV. Flanders shares her observations on the protest in Madison, Wisconsin. She says the struggles for collective bargaining are no longer just about solidarity, but about survival in itself.
Collective bargaining is a huge part of what this struggle is about. To be able to combine with others, to talk with others, to work with others, not to be left all alone, to be fired in the playground of your high school. But I will say that I don't think a concept of solidarity was at the heart of what we saw. I don't think it's what gave it that spark. I think what was at the heart was a realization that it wasn't just about solidarity, it was about a fight for survival, personal survival. Monica Adams here from Freedom Inc. said a very powerful thing on Grit TV. She said, you know, on principle I showed up for the unions even though they haven't always shown up for me. Because I believe in the principle of collective bargaining. But you know, it wasn't just about, for me, the right to negotiate about my life. It was about the right to have a life. It's about the right for my uncle who's diabetic to have his medications. For my sister, for my children, for myself. This is personal, this is me. And the people of Freedom Inc., largely young people, people of color, women led, said, we're glad you've all joined our fight. But we've been fighting this fight for a long time. We're glad you finally got here. So the question becomes, what happens next? And whose survival do we think this is about? Do we yet really believe this is about our survival, those of us in this room? We are living in a country now with 59 million people without health insurance, and the fees are going up because there's no cap, no control. 49 million people living in poverty, 44 million living on food stamps. You've got that 400 with the wealth equivalent to the 125 million of the rest of us. I think we had a spark. Maybe it was Egypt, maybe it was Tunisia. And it fell on a very dry field, and we had some wind that blew, courtesy of independent media and you. We managed to make some change. And that was part of what stopped this ramrod politics. The other thing that I think that stopped the ramrod politics was the sense of recognition that there is a reason the public unions are being attacked. And it's not just to attack public unions. It's also so that there will be no resistance when the cuts come. There'll be no last line of defense. And there was a realization, it's not just about jobs, it's about dignity. The question of collective bargaining is not just about pay, it's about your right to have a say in your workplace. So this sense that this is about more than just the details, more than anything having to do with the money that's the only thing we're supposed to be thinking about, was palpable in Wisconsin. And I think people heard a noise. They heard a noise of each other talking. They heard a noise of each other telling their stories about their lives. And they realized, wow, how loud that noise could be. And the eagerness for connection was everywhere. But I don't think we should be unrealistic when it comes to what structural entities exist. What structural entities exist to be able to carry this organizing forward. We have a beautiful, spontaneous thing that wasn't top-down, it was bottom-up. But we have 30 years of fracturing that divides us, that has led people to believe that they're one another's enemy, that somebody else has, which means you won't get yours. We have 30 years of fracturing to try to overcome. Will solidarity alone do it? I don't know. We do have people ready, a dry field and some wind. We need operational unity, we need institutions. And then I think finally we need vision. You know, the slogan inside the Capitol, and the Capitol was held for all those days by young people. The slogan inside the Capitol was, whose house, our house? And I think we want to think about that too. How many people in this room have experienced unemployment in the last 3 years? How many people in this room are struggling with mortgages, mortgage debt, credit card debt, student debt? How many people in this room know somebody who's serving in the military? This isn't somewhere else. This is right here. Whose house? Our house. Thanks.
We'll be right back. You're listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. If you'd like more information or for CD copies of this program, please call 800-529-5736. Because of listeners like you, this show is distributed for free to radio stations in the U.S., Canada, and South Africa. To find out how to support us, download shows, or get our podcast, go to radioproject.org. We now return to Cornell West, Paul Mason, and Laura Flanders on Redefining Solidarity. Up next is Professor Cornell West. He's the author of numerous books and currently teaches at the Center for African American Studies and Department of Religion at Princeton University. He argues that solidarity is passed from generation to generation and that we must embrace the past in order to move forward.
We talk about politics of solidarity, that we're not just talking about the present. We need to bring together the three dimensions of time, the past, the present, and the future. When I think of solidarity, I want to be in solidarity with Martin Luther King Jr. I want to be in solidarity with Paul Robeson. I want to be in solidarity with Norman Thomas. Solidarity has to do with those in the past who are wrestling with the same question that we are wrestling is, which is, what does it mean to be a leftist? What does it mean to be progressive? Do we really have the courage to engage on a quest for the truth, understanding that the condition of truth is to allow suffering to speak? And when you allow suffering to speak, all of a sudden, those France Fanon called the wretched of the earth begin to raise their voices. Poor people, working people, those wrestling with white supremacy and male supremacy, those wrestling with homophobia, those wrestling with imperial subjugation. They could be in Latin America, Asia, Africa. They can be in the Middle East. They can be in Central America, allowing their voices to be heard. Why? Because their humanity has been rendered invisible. Oftentimes, they have been viewed as superfluous people who do not matter, who do not count. And to be a leftist in the 19th century, the 20th century, or the 21st century is to say we are in solidarity with, namely, we just don't work alongside. We actually love those brothers and sisters. We care for those brothers and sisters. We don't care what color they are. Black, red, yellow, brown, or whatever, and we're going down fighting because we're concerned about their humanity. We want them to live lives in such a way that they can flower and flourish. And isn't it something that to believe that is to be radical? Can you imagine what the powers that be must be like to believe something so simple as that? But that's what we're dealing with. We're dealing with beginning with the catastrophic. To be a leftist is to begin with the catastrophic. To begin with those persons who are dominated, subjugated, devalued, demeaned, and marginalized. And to look at the world through their lens. And that means that we cut radically against the grain in the last 40 years, especially in the American empire, where we have been told lies. Unfettered markets generating self-sufficiency, prosperity, and justice is a lie. White supremacy is a lie. Male supremacy is a lie. Homophobia is a lie. We simply say we want to stand for the truth. And in addition to that, it is to say that we attempt to be courageous because we live in catastrophic times, and no doubt, our brothers and sisters in Japan, deep solidarity. The children locked into human slavery. The women dealing with sexual violence. The gay brothers and lesbian sisters spit on in so many contexts. Black folk in America, in Central America, in Latin America still taught to hate themselves and believe they have less intelligence and less beauty. That's ugly. That's a lie that hurts. It hurts deeply. And that's why when you talk about being a leftist, you're talking about being a certain kind of human being, namely a courageous human being. And we've been living in catatonic times alongside catastrophic times because there's so much sleepwalking going on. The numbing that has taken place, the indifference toward people, especially poor people and working people, with greed running amok at the top, Wall Street oligarchs looting not just the public treasury, but the shadowy financial system generating billions of dollars when 21% of America's children of all colors living in poverty and 38% are brown. And let us never forget our red brothers and sisters, our indigenous brothers and sisters. They don't need to be in the room for us to talk about their suffering. It's their babies and their land that was dispossessed. 1492 was the beginning of World War I for them, and it's been continuous ever since. That's a perspective to understand what it is to create a American democratic experiment in all of its nobility. Now, there are some noble elements to American democracy. I would be the first to say so. But there's some vicious, imperial, racist, sexist, homophobic, classist elements too. And we have to be honest about it. And we haven't had enough people to be courageous. Why? Because after the death of Martin in 68, and after the repression of the social movements in the 60s and 70s, feminist and anti-homophobic and racial and class movements, so many folk caved in and decided they'd rather be comfortable than free. They'd rather be well-adjusted to injustice and well-adapted to indifference than really be in solidarity with those who came before, the great forefathers and foremothers of all colors who said, we want to be courageous in our quest for truth, allowing suffering to speak, and in our deep love and care for those folk catching hell. And one of the challenges is, how do we pass this on to the younger generation? We have got to highlight young people. Why? Because it's the young folk who have been in the vanguard in Northern Africa in the last few weeks, who have been willing to sacrifice to live and die for some grand democratic ideal in the face of U.S.-backed tyranny. It's been the young folk who are beginning now to awaken. And the question becomes, how do we pass it on? Well, the first thing you do is Sankofa. You look back. Why? Because when we look at their examples, we see people who are rare these days, which is what? They will not sell themselves for the highest bidder. They won't sell themselves for a mess of pottage. They refuse to be sold. And everybody these days is up for sale. Nearly everybody's up for sale. That's the difference of the younger generation vis-a-vis when I was coming along. When I looked and saw Huey Newton, saw Bob Avakian and some other folk, whether I agreed with them or not ideologically, I knew they could never sell out. They had integrity. They had a willingness to sacrifice. They had vision. They were concerned about what they were talking about. These days, it's hard to find that in a younger generation so hungry for it. They're so thirsty for it. What is all this talk about leftist discourse? How do you translate it into lived experience? How does it become real in my life? That's the question of the younger generation. And I said, you can listen to a little Curtis Mayfield and listen to some Bob Dylan. Listen to a little Bruce Springsteen. Why? Because, yes, it's in the culture, it's in the arts, it's in the music that so many of our young folk are going to really be radicalized. And then they're able to engage in those subtle analysis of American empire and the military overreach and the 850 military branches around the world and a ship in every ocean and why it is that Latin America and Brazil and why it is in Venezuela and why it is in India and China presents a challenge to the American empire and why it is that the Wall Street oligarchs and the corporate elites are sucking so much of the blood of American democracy in such a way that more and more people are just useless, superfluous, and they don't care, and they think they can get away with it because there's been no resistance of large scale, and they think in the end that chickens don't come home to roost, that you don't reap what you sow, that sooner or later what's in the wash gonna come out in the rinse, and we simply say it left for them. We stand for the truth. And if you think that everyday people are simply gonna take it, generation after generation, echoes of the ninth thesis of Walter Benjamin when he talked about the catastrophe and the piling of wreckage upon wreckage of every generation. Look at the black community. Look at the brown community in New York City. Levels of unemployment, 30 and 40% for 45 years. And lo and behold, people start going, oh, we might have a new permanent underclass. Look again. It's already been here. Look again. They've been suffering all that time. Look again. We can be in solidarity at the deepest level if we understand that we need our analysis broader, but most importantly, our courage in place that weds our hearts and our minds, but also our bodies. Our bodies. And that's what young folk are looking for, because we can't overlook the challenge of the younger generation. Connecting past, present, and future. Connecting the catastrophic, the catatonic, and now the catalyst. The awakening is taking place. Left form is an integral part of that. Let us do our role.
And that's it for this edition of Making Contact. You've been listening to excerpts from Left Forum's Towards a Politics of Solidarity, featuring Paul Mason, Laura Flanders, and Cornell West. A link to the entire full-length discussion is available on our website, radioproject.org. Special thanks to Left Forum, Dred Scott Keyes, and WBAI for the audio. For a CD copy of this program, call the National Radio Project at 800-529-5736 or check out our website at radioproject.org to get a podcast, download past shows, or make a difference by supporting our work. Lisa Rudman is our executive director, Khan Pham, associate director, Andrew Stelzer, and Kyung Jin Lee, producers. Carl Jung Bondensing, volunteer coordinator. Lisa Bartfi, production intern, Irene Flores, web intern, and Dan Turner, Ron Rucker, Alton Bird, Judy Huang, and Alex Collins are our volunteers. I'm Esther Mania. Thanks for listening to Making Contact.